A man goes down at a college football game. One down, possibly not breathing. Within just a few seconds, a police officer is doing chest compressions. Another officer has grabbed an AED off of a hallway wall and has gotten pads on the man's chest. Paramedics converge from two different directions. A physician standing on the concourse activates a specialized cardiac team at a nearby hospital with a single phone call. 20 people, most of whom have never met, work on one stranger's heart in a room that was built for serving food. The man survived. Weeks later, he walked up to an ambulance on a cane, stuck out his hand, and introduced himself to the crews. I was there that day, working as a volunteer emergency medical technician, or EMT, and I could not stop thinking about what I had watched. 20 strangers, 3 agencies, no rehearsal together, near total silence, and a man's life was saved. 2 weeks later, at age 51, I enrolled in paramedic school. Now, as you know, I have spent 25 years helping companies get ready for their worst day. This past year, I spent 7 months riding an ambulance here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, meeting people on their worst day. This episode is about what this has taught me about resilience that the boardroom never could. Because here's the thesis, and I'm going to say it a couple times today. Resilience is not just a program. It is a set of small, repeated, deliberate practices. And working on an ambulance proves it on every shift. I'm Brian Strauser, Principal and Chief Executive here at BrightPath, and this is the Managing Uncertainty Podcast. Today's episode is a little different. It's personal. But I promise that this pays off professionally. Some of you know this story. Most of you maybe have not heard it. But over the past year, alongside running BrightPath, I was spending a lot of my free time back in school, paramedic school. 11 months of coursework, 7 months of clinical shifts on a 911 ambulance in the Twin Cities Metro, 433.5 clinical hours. I saw 180 patients that ranged from 1 day old to 93 years old. I dealt with cardiac arrests and strokes and traumas and overdoses and a whole slew of quiet calls that never make it into your favorite TV medical drama. Last week, I passed my final exams and my oral boards. The National Registry exam is the last thing I have left, and then I will be able to upgrade from EMT to paramedic and begin volunteering as a medic instead of just an EMT. BrightPath will continue on its own deliberate path, and I'll still be here. That's a story for another day. Today, I want to give you 5 resilience lessons that I carried out of the back of that ambulance. These are not metaphors that I invented just to make a cute episode. These are things that I watched work over and over and over, under conditions that your crisis team at your company will recognize. Incomplete information, compressed time, high stakes, and strangers who have to function together as a team over the next 90 seconds. 5 lessons. So let's get into this. The plan is the foundation. Contact is the refinement. In paramedic school, I would say that you learn what we might think of as book medicine. We learn the academic theory, the reasons behind the things that we will be dealing with. The National Registry, which is the group that maintains our certification tests, teaches us that a patient assessment is a rigid sequence of things that flow one step after another, and they are designed for one person or one crew doing one thing at a time. You memorize this. You are tested on this, both academically through written testing and practically in that you have to perform it in front of an examiner who's grading every move. And you can't pass it without knowing how this is going to work. Then you get on the street in your clinicals and you learn that no real scene actually works that way. In my case, as the third rider on a crew, one person was as my preceptor, and then there was another paramedic or EMT, and then there's me, the paramedic student. There's 3 of us. So while I'm interviewing the patient, my partner might already be taking vital signs using a cardiac monitor. The vital signs arrive early, and they might change the next questions that I ask. It's not a step-by-step-by-step process the way that we do when we're learning how to do this from the book. everything happens in parallel. And here's what a new medic gets wrong about that gap and what a lot of executives get wrong about their crisis plans. They conclude that the book was useless, and that's not true. The saying in EMS is one I would put on the wall of every crisis program in America. Street medicine is book medicine refined by experience. The foundation of every good street, of all good street medicine, is good textbook medicine. You can't refine what you never learned. Your crisis plan at your company or your business continuity plans, well, that's the book medicine. It's necessary and correct, and it is incomplete until contact with a real event or a realistic exercise. And then those teach you what it actually means. The plan on the shelf isn't wrong. It's just unrefined and sometimes unpracticed. And so that's why we exercise, not to validate the binder, but to refine it. Every tabletop, every simulation, these are your organization's clinical rotations. The second lesson for resilience is that real emergencies are quiet. Now, you've probably watched TV. You probably watched a medical show on TV. And you probably think about someone in cardiac arrest as being a loud event with a lot of yelling and screaming. But let me tell you what it really sounds like, because television has lied to you about what that is. I've never been at a resuscitation with shouting, not a single one. The loudest thing in the room is the mechanical CPR device, called a Lucas, thumping, and maybe the family talking behind us with their concerns and greatest fears. The professionals, police, fire, EMS, are procedural and direct and collaborative and polite to each other. There's long stretches, and this will surprise everyone in a cardiac arrest, where it looks like almost nothing is happening. The machine compresses. Someone is managing the airway. Someone is helping breathe for the patient. Someone is pushing medications to try to turn around this resuscitation. Everyone else is quietly counting down to that next timed intervention, the next pulse check, the next rhythm check, the next time we have to give medication. And how is that possible? Strangers from three agencies, police, fire, and EMS, people who may have never met, working on a dying human being in near silence, without negotiation, without yelling and screaming and drama. And it's because every one of us is running the same algorithm. Cardiac arrest care in the world runs on a shared one-page framework. It's a diagram, an algorithmic diagram of what to do. 2 minutes of CPR, check the rhythm, decide if we can shock this rhythm, repeat. Everyone knows the loop. Nobody has to discuss the loop in the moment. The framework is how we all cooperate together without having ever met before. Now walk into the average corporate crisis room. Shouting is not a rare thing there sometimes. Neither is improv or duplicated efforts or 12 people asking who's in charge and what should we do. Chaos in a crisis room is not a sign of urgency. It's a symptom of a missing shared framework. If your team has a common operating structure, clear roles, and a battle rhythm that everybody knows, your worst day in a corporation gets quiet. And quiet is what competence sounds like. The third lesson is about moving on partial information and then refining it en route. Here's how 911 actually works for medical calls, and most people don't know this. When you call for a medical emergency, the dispatcher takes a few basic facts and then dispatches an ambulance and maybe fire as well, depending upon the severity of the call. And they do that immediately, before the caller has even stopped explaining. And while we're en route to that call as a medic EMT team, the call notes update live on a screen in the ambulance as the dispatcher keeps working the call, and that picture gets sharper en route. Here's the thing everybody learns quickly, is that the call maybe isn't always quite the actual call. I've had things dispatched as a fainting episode and have it be something else entirely. I've been on calls that were dispatched as a sick person, and the blood pressure and vital signs tell me something else. That initial information is often wrong or partial on a huge share of calls, but we go anyway, and we refine what we know along the way. Now compare that to the executive team that gets word of a ransomware event, or a supplier failure, or an emerging reputational issue, and decides to wait for more information before activating. There's no, that is an ambulance just idling in the garage until the diagnosis gets confirmed. The 911 system settled this design question years and years ago. We should dispatch on partial information always, because the cost of rolling and being wrong is minutes of fuel. The cost of waiting and being right could be a life. Your corporate version of the math is almost identical, by the way. Activating your team and then sanding them down later is just costing you a meeting and some time. Those waiting costs, waiting can cost you the window where you're, when your options still existed at the start of this crisis. So move first, refine it en route. The truth can wait for you at the scene. Number four of my lessons is to stand in the command zone. This one cost me some pride. So like a lot of clinicals is a little bit like getting kicked in the face all the time, learning lessons through failure and criticism, but that's how you learn. So this one cost me some pride. So I know that it's a real lesson. About three quarters of the way through my training, I led a call at a park. A woman had collapsed. And by the time that the call was done, we had four firefighter EMTs, two experienced paramedics, and me at that scene. The clinical plan here was pretty sound. The patient did just fine. And in the debrief afterward at the hospital, my preceptor and her partner gave me some feedback that mattered, which was, Brian, you landed on the right answers, but I want you to think about where you were on the call and what you were doing. I had planted myself at the patient's side, doing tasks that any one of the seven trained EMS professionals at the scene could have done, instead of standing where I could see everything that was going on, the patient, the providers, the family, and the crowd. There was a name for that spot in EMS, according to one of my partners that day, the command zone. Then my preceptor pulls out her phone and showed me a painting from 1891 from Luke Fildes. And the painting is called The Doctor. And you can Google the photo. It's a physician at a sick child's bedside at the crisis point of an illness. And he's not touching the patient. He's not doing a thing to the patient. He's watching. And every ounce of power in that painting is his attention of what is going on. Now, I've taught executive crisis leadership for almost 30 years. I have said the words, the leader's job is position and attention and communication, not doing the work, in 100 boardrooms. And I still had to relearn this while standing in a park from a paramedic with a Victorian painting on her phone. So that can happen to me. It's happening to your incident leaders. It's happening to your CEO. Under stress, leaders grab tasks because tasks feel like they're making progress. Watch your next exercise for this. The leader who is heads down doing work that anybody on the team could do has vacated the one job that no one else can do. So find your command zone and stand in that. My last lesson was the heaviest lesson. And I have talked about things like this on the podcast before. On a call, in the moment, an EMS professional, an EMT or a paramedic, we box up what we're feeling, the emotions that we're having in response to what is happening, so that our hands can keep working, so that we can keep leading at the scene. That skill is real and necessary. And your crisis teams do this too. It's how your people and you got through COVID, through the layoffs that you've had to be involved in and administer, through the incident calls that happen at 3 a.m., through loss of life and terrible accidents and violent crimes that have happened at your company. This is how you have gotten through that. But I think the EMS world knows something that the corporate world mostly refuses to say and say it out loud. And that is that we box up the feelings, and that's really only half the skill. The other half is taking the time to unpack those deliberately afterward. And the profession has the scars to prove what happens when people skip it. Studies put PTSD prevalence among paramedics at about 20%, against about 3% in the general working population. More than a third of fire and EMS professionals report having contemplated suicide. And annual turnover can run 20 to 30% in some cases. So the culture builds the unpacking in. After a death, crews at the service where I did my clinicals observe a scripted pause, a moment of silence, honoring the patient before we leave the room or the scene. Before going back into service, every crew I've ever ridden with, when we've lost a patient, has taken a moment to check in with each other. Are you okay? Do you need something? Do you need anything? There are peer support teams at my agency that you can reach around the clock, and they're real, not just a pamphlet. And every medic that I asked about how they deal with the stress had a personal practice, the gym, the lake, their church. For me, it's the drive home, conversations with my family, and journaling, which is how I get it out of the boxes and onto paper while it's still true and feels more settled to me. The corporate translation of this is, and I want to be blunt, your crisis responders, your security operations teams, your communicators, your HR teams who have to deal with terrible news, and yourself. We all carry the same kind of load with none of the same kind of infrastructure. Most resilience programs I review are endurance programs. They build the boxing skill, and it's modeled from the top to be affected by hard things. We box it up so that we can perform, but we want to unpack this so that we can last. And any program that teaches only the first half is quietly consuming its own people. So let me bring this home. 25 years in boardrooms and in resilience work has taught me the vocabulary of resilience. 7 months on an ambulance taught me the anatomy of it. And it looks like a plan that has been refined by contact, not laminated in shelves. It sounds quiet because everyone knows the framework and their role in it. It moves on partial information and it sharpens the picture en route. Its leaders stand where they can see everything but touch almost nothing because they're leading. And it takes deliberate structural care of the people who do the work because it intends to keep them. Resilience is not a program. It is a set of small, repeated, deliberate practices. The ambulance proves that on every shift. Your organization can prove it too, and you don't have to wait for your own worst day to start. If you found this episode useful, do me a favor. Subscribe to the Managing Uncertainty podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a rating. Share this one with a leader you respect, especially one who thinks that resilience just lives in a binder. And one more thing from the almost new paramedic in me, go learn CPR. Learn how to stop severe bleeding by taking a Stop the Bleed course. And never, ever hesitate to call 911. You'll have 20 strangers that will come and help you. I've counted them. That's it for this edition of the Managing Uncertainty podcast. I'll be back next week with another new episode. Be well.